from KQED. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, bad backs. More than 25% of American adults say they've recently suffered from back pain, and whether dealing with chronic or situational pain, people in the U.S. spend at least $50 billion a year trying to make their backs feel better. And the strategies for doing just that vary widely, from exercise and posture corrections to acupuncture and massage and even surgery. Back pain's a big problem and a big business. In the hour ahead, we'll talk with some experts in the field, hear about current research, and take your calls. That's all coming your way on Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in today for Michael Krasny. Chronic pain can make daily life a struggle, and one of the most common laments among adults in the U.S. seems to be that of an aching back. In fact, a quarter of American adults say they have recently dealt with lower back pain. The personal and financial toll of bad backs is steep. Lost days at work, lost time with kids and family and friends, lost dollars to treatments, remedies, doctors, and prevention strategies. Back pain is such a pervasive problem in the U.S. that it's become a big business as well. There are as many approaches to treatment and prevention as there are ways to throw out your back. Exercise, physical therapy, massage and acupuncture, steroids and surgery, people will tap into whatever brings relief. Every strategy has its benefits, but is the current research today giving us any clues about what therapies might be most effective for tackling the pain? And with such a big pool of people impacted by bad backs, we thought it was time to take a look at the topic and talk with some people who work with those in pain about how to handle it and how to avoid it. With us for the program is Amy Selinger. She's a physical therapist and owner of, she runs a practice called Back to Life Physical Therapy here in San Francisco. Good morning to you, Amy.
Good morning.
Also with us is Esther Gokhale. She's the creator of something called the Gokhale Method, which is in many ways a posture-based approach to managing your back health. And she runs the Gokhale Method Institute in Palo Alto and also has a book called 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back. Good morning to you.
Glad to be here.
And with us as well is Dr. Paul Slozar. He's an orthopedic surgeon, a spine surgeon, and he works with Spine Care Medical Group here in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Paul Slozar, I want to start with you and ask you to comment on just, our high rates of back pain and back injury, what you think is going on with Americans and our back health, and also what some of the current research is showing us about what we can be doing about it.
There's a couple of things that are happening just demographically as the baby boomers approach 60 plus, just the sheer numbers of people who've been upright for decades is increasing. By virtue of that fact, more people are just destined to have to contact the medical community with simple mechanical problems and more complex back issues.
So what you're saying is aging is one major factor.
The more time we're upright and the more time we sit, there's a pretty distinct correlation with worsening degeneration of the low back. That's for sure.
And is there something, though, that you can also say about the American lifestyle in particular, since our numbers seem to be remarkable, that is playing into our rates of 1 in 4 with just even specifically lower back? So that doesn't even factor in the neck pain, the upper back.
No, it's a great point, and it is not unique to the United States. It's a worldwide issue, and as we've become, if you will, more sedentary, sitting more, we are seeing a whole group of patients that are probably destined to have more back pain than the previous generations, just by the lack of inactivity. But when you look at how many people are if you will, aging in a healthy manner. Their heart, their lungs, they're not smoking, they're trying to stay in shape. We're all here at this table seeing increasing numbers of fit, active patients in their 60s and 70s who are now struggling with disabling back pain.
Is the medical community in agreement in general about some of the basic ways to tackle this problem of a growing population of folks with back pain? Is there a consensus of some of the best approaches?
I wouldn't say there's a consensus. It certainly depends on who you speak to. Excuse me. I think the traditional medical community would be comfortable with the idea that in the first 3 months of if you will, benign low back pain, no neurologic concerns, no concerning problems such as infection or tumor, but patients who just have simple mechanical back pain, I think most of us are comfortable letting the patients find their own path. That can be physical therapy. It could be postural retraining, chiropractic care, home exercises and stretching. I don't think there's data that supports that any one discipline is more effective in the first 3 months. If you now look at patients who might have 6 to 12 months of low back pain, those patients need to be evaluated typically by a specialist. An MRI is usually the most effective way to sort that out, because then patients either need to decide, are they going to actively engage with more sophisticated treatment, or are they going to work on a more long-term management program with biomechanics, ergonomics, physical fitness? You can manage these things chronically effectively, but sometimes patients do need treatment to help them along.
And from your point of view, from the medical point of view, what are there things that people do that take a situational, like a back injury, somebody throwing out their back in an active, something happens, a car accident or a sports thing, a weekend warrior thing, that then leads to it becoming chronic back pain when it didn't need to?
I may differ from some of my colleagues in this response, but I believe that the innocent injuries will respond to simple treatments. I believe it's the personality of the injury. If it becomes chronic, it's more likely than not some sort of mechanical injury, a disc, a facet joint, something that has been damaged mechanically. And those patients are the ones that often transition after 6 months into chronic back pain, where the patients who've sustained, if you will, a more simple injury, something that could be corrected with postural retraining, physical therapy, good body mechanics, those patients will typically recover within 3 to 6 months.
In an ordinary way, without it growing into a chronic problem.
Yeah, I really don't think that it's the patient or the treating physician or therapist's failure in those first 3 to 6 months. I think it speaks more to, did the patient really sustain a significant mechanical injury to a disc or a facet joint?
All right. Talking this hour about back pain, and what we'd love to hear from our callers this hour is strategies that might have worked for you. So we know lots and lots of people struggle with back pain and chronic back pain, and we're very interested in hearing from people who have found things that work, strategies, approaches, techniques that have worked in ameliorating pain, preventing pain, managing pain. So give us a call. Give us a call whether you have a strategy or not, but especially those folks who have figured something out that works for them. We would love to hear different tricks of the back pain management trade. So give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Well, Esther Gokhale, I want to go to you and ask you specifically about your technique. You have a very specific approach to back pain, back management, and back health. And my understanding is that you suffered terrible back pain yourself when you were younger, and all of this was born out of that.
Yeah, you develop your passions the hard way sometimes. So I had an L5-S1 disc herniation, wouldn't respond to any of the usual conservative or alternative approaches, ended up with surgery, and then a year later ended up re-herniating the same L5-S1 disc and was proposed another surgery. So it's not an atypical route. And I decided it. I was in my mid-20s, and you know, back surgery is not a habit you want to evolve. And so I was forced to step outside the box, look at a bigger picture and so on. And so my discoveries, you know, they worked so well for me. I managed to avoid the second surgery, and it's now been over 20 years. I've not had a back pain, not a twinge, not an ache. And so now I get to share it with other people. And
tell us about your approach.
The philosophy is that the problem isn't that we haven't evolved to be upright. We've been upright for over 5 million years, and there are populations who do very well upright, and it behooves us to observe them, see what they're doing, and understand that we don't have a sufficient knowledge of the body to approach it like an engineering problem. We're better off at this juncture to approach it anthropologically and historically. Here we have populations that function well. Let's see what they're doing. Let's mimic them. And then let's understand secondarily, you know?
So you call on, in your book, in your work, on your website, you call on cultures where there's this gorgeous posture being exhibited every day, people walking with beautiful things on their head, and be they young, old, the posture is erect. And that, you argue, I think, is the trick.
Yeah, it's captivating. And more than that, the research pans out. You know, there is woefully little, but there is research done on these people, the epidemiological research of Volin, for example, showing that these populations have much, much lower incidence of back pain and other musculoskeletal problems. So
what do you do with patients that come to you?
And we call them students, because what we're doing is empowering them. We're not giving them fish, we're teaching them to fish. And we're teaching them to return to the structure and movement patterns that they used to have when they were little, and that their ancestors had. And you don't even have to go that far back. If you go back 100 years ago or more, you find these same movement patterns. And you can also look to these other cultures, which unfortunately are becoming fewer and further between. But there's the secret. And then if you learn to bend like they do and lie like they do and walk like they do, it's surprising how much improvement there is.
One thing I noticed, and I'm not sure where I saw it, if it was Esther Gokhale on your material or Amy in yours, where I saw it, but it was very interesting to me that the movement of squatting, which is used in much of the world for, you know, hanging out on the sidewalk or hanging out with friends or even, you know, for the toilet, that squatting is a very human movement and we don't do it at all in our culture. Amy?
Right. Kids stop squatting after about age 3 when they start sitting more and more. You can see children on the playground playing. 2-year-olds will squat to play, but by the time they're about 3, they've stopped that. And they start, after they've been sitting for a while, the way they bend over is to bend from their back and from their hips. And so what ends up happening is that we make our back more and more flexible and our hips and knees and ankles less and less flexible over time. And the kind of chairs that I don't know about you all, but the kind of chairs that I sat in school actually encouraged slumping and encouraged the knees to be higher than the hips and encouraged leaning, kind of slumping over the desk, so that encourages, we know that rounding and twisting your back is the most likely thing to cause a herniated disc. So we're literally putting our kids in that position for hours and hours a day. And then you get actually stronger in your thigh muscles than you are in your abdominal muscles after all of that.
With all the slumping, with all the sitting.
And not strong in your buttocks and your small hip rotator muscles, which what are required to sit and squat on your haunches.
That was so interesting to me because, you know, you would think that a flexible back, that's a lovely term. You would want a flexible back, which I'm sure you do, but we've lost our flexibility in our hips.
Right. We want balanced flexibility. You want your back and your hips and knees and ankles to be evenly balanced in flexibility and strength.
And Paul, so did I see you wanting to jump in on that?
Well, on a practical side and representing the orthopedic side, one of the most difficult problems, and I ask my patients in the office if they're capable of squatting, and show them I'm still capable and trying to remain so. But if they have a bad hip or a bad knee, it's a toxic combination because they will preferentially move through their back, bend at the waist, and they'll keep their knee or their hip protected if there's a cartilage tear or something. So I'll often send them to have that repaired or dealt with, because if I send them to Amy or to a therapist and they've got a bad knee, they can't get started on those kind of exercises.
And they will actually hurt in their back more likely than hurt their knee and hip. It's interesting to watch people. They will preferentially say, that hurts in my back, but it's easier than squatting.
Or- oh, that's so interesting. So it's, I mean, the hip bone is connected to, as they say, Esther Gokhale.
I fully agree that modern chairs encourage slumping and that people bend poorly. But I don't see the solution as squatting, for example, because it's not what we've done growing up when our ankles and knee joints and so on ossified. So once that's done, you can't go back in time and squat the way a three-year-old does. That's done. It's written in your bone. And the solution is not the Asian squatting solution, but the African hip hinging solution.
Oh, where they bend over with a very
straight back. And that solution is available to modern Westerners.
Why? Because our hips didn't ossify in the same way?
Well, no, it's because that hip joint has got lots of range of motion. What prevents us from doing things well is that we have very tight hamstrings. But with the right training, which is very doable, people are very coachable in this, they can learn to hip hinge, and increasingly so. And then hip hinging becomes the solution for those tight hamstrings.
Okay. And describe, I can picture in my mind because I know what you're talking about, but describe for listeners who may not have a visual picture of this, what hip hinging is.
So you don't want to experiment willy-nilly with this because you want to do it very correctly. But you have as much give in your knee or bend in your knee as you need, given your current hamstring inflexibility. The back remains very tall, very well shaped, maybe braced if you're going to be lifting weights and so on. And the only place that moves is your hip joint.
Because of the pictures I've seen, the back is almost lordosis. It's almost curved in rather than humped over, concave. It's almost, what would the term be, convex?
It remains the same shape that it was when you were upright.
Okay.
It doesn't become swayed, but it certainly doesn't become rounded because that puts a lot of stress on the discs and so on.
All right. Well, let's go to, we've got a full bank of calls, and let's be courteous to the callers who have their own strategies and they hear from you. We've got Lisa calling us from Belmont. Good morning.
Hi there. I have found various tricks to help with low back pain, and one of which is doing bridges. So you lay flat on the floor with your knees bent and then your feet flat on the floor, and you raise your low back and your hips up. When I had a fall and first injured my back, that's all I could do in physical therapy. And if it's really acute at first, you don't necessarily have to raise your hips all the way up.
All right. Well, let's hear from Amy Salinger about the mechanics of that and why that is a good strategy.
So that will work for some people because the idea is that you're strengthening your abdominal and gluteal muscles. It won't work for other people because most people who are very strong in their hamstrings will do it with their hamstrings, and it can actually make the problem worse. So I think one of the things that we'll find from both all of us in this room as well as different people calling is that different bodies need different approaches because we have different length arms and legs. We have different stiffnesses of our muscles. Some people are have very strong muscles that seem to bulk up as soon as they go to the gym, and other people, they never seem to look any different no matter how many weights they lift. So bodies are different and muscle tone is different. And so strategies will be different in terms of what will help you.
Well, and it sounds like, you know, so much of back health is going to be based on your muscle development in different parts of your body. And it won't even be that you're necessarily out of shape or overweight, or it's just that if you've got underdeveloped glute muscles, that's going to impact, or underdeveloped any other muscles, that impacts something like your back, which seems unrelated.
That's exactly it. And what we would do in physical therapy is take a look at you personally and see what muscles that you have that are kind of long and maybe weak in their actions, and which muscles are a bit short and too strong in their actions, and help you balance that by strengthening specifically the ones that are long and weak.
Well, Esther Gokhale, I know you work with a lot of Silicon Valley folks. In fact, I think the New York Times referred to you something like the guru of Silicon Valley, Google-esque world people. But as somebody who works with people who, you know, this computer world that we live in, especially here in the Bay Area, where people sit at computers all day, talk about having underdeveloped certain muscles and overdeveloped other ones. What do you, for these chair dwellers, what do you offer as options?
So these chair dwellers are also usually really busy people. And giving them, you know, filling up half of their disposable time is not really, you know, a tremendous service. So what we try to do, and successfully, is give them everyday activities that they're doing anyway and tweak them so that they're getting their exercise needs and, therapy needs met in the course of everyday activities. So, for example, glutes. If you walk really well, every step is a rep. So, you know, I could teach someone 10 minutes or 10 reps of strengthening their glutes, or I could teach them to walk in such a way that every step is doing that exercise for them. And it's not rocket science. So this is our approach. You know, it takes a little bit of investment in learning. But once they've learned, it takes no extra time, no fancy equipment.
You're not thinking about the program you're building. You're thinking about what number you're on for for glute tweaks or something. But
it.
At least you're building,
you know,
it into
10,000 a day, they say, right? Steps. So.
Paul Slozar?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in that another, you know, tip, and you noticed that the two people who are discussing the therapy side of this are referencing students, not patients, mm-hmm. and training. The most important muscle is between our ears. And if you don't get in front of somebody and pay attention to educating yourself about how to be smart with your back, how to integrate these exercises in your day-to-day activities, it's hopeless. So while training our abdominal muscles and our glutes are important, you have to train the muscle between your ears first, and that's key.
So if I was to come into you as a patient into a doctor's office and say, boy, my back's been killing me and I'm finding it really interrupting my daily life, and it was this basic thing that kind of a lot of people have, which is not debilitating, excruciating pain, but chronic low back pain. As a physician, as an orthopedist, what would your first line of attack be? What would you tell me to do?
If it's the simple variety, which is the most common, and there's no concerning neurologic concerns or the problem has been self-limited, let's say 3 months or less, I would engage the patient and ask them, well, what do you like to do? Are you physically fit? Are you active? Do you have exposure to therapy, chiropractor? What have you done in the past? And I try to spin my recommendations off what they might be interested in, because if I give them something that's completely foreign to them or of no interest, they won't follow through. I generally try to connect them with active trainers, physical therapists that have engaged in the past with my experience, engaged the patients on an individual basis, tailored a program that works for them, and give them exercises. I have good relationships with a lot of chiropractic physicians, but some of the drawbacks, if they don't also offer active physical training and education, it's too passive. The chiropractic treatment, once the patient's completed, they need to then pick it up themselves. So I try to get them connected with somebody who will educate them.
Boy, and I can imagine it sort of becomes a snowball effect or a slippery slope, whatever you want to call it, because somebody with chronic back pain doesn't want to go out and exercise and doesn't want to go do stuff because it hurts. And then that begets either more discomfort sitting around on the couch, or you go out and try to do something and then you hurt your back. So let's talk more after a short break about different things that we can be doing to keep our backs healthy in the first place, and also some more office tricks. I'd love to hear about what people can do while they sit at their desks, sit at their computers, and I'd love to hear more from our callers as well. We'll go to your calls after a break. The number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Our guests this hour, Esther Gokhale, Amy Selinger, and Dr. Paul Slozar, and talking about back health. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Penny Nelson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour about managing and preventing bad facts. With us for the discussion are three guests. We've got orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Paul Slozar with us. He's with the Spine Care Medical Group in San Francisco. Also with us from San Francisco is physical therapist Amy Selinger, and her practice is called Back to Life Physical Therapy. And Esther Gokhale joins us as well. She's the author of 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back and creator of what is called the Gokhale Method, and runs an institute out of Palo Alto and a practice out of Palo Alto, and serves as an advisor to many folks down in Silicon Valley who have long days sitting slumped over a computer screen and trying to manage backs at the same time. And if you'd like to join us, the conversation is largely about ways to tackle back pain. Maybe you could offer up some suggestions about what's worked for you. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website at kqed.org/forum. And I promise we're going to go to calls and emails, but I know, Amy Selinger, you wanted to comment and respond to what was just said before the break.
I think in physical therapy, we try to do much of what Esther said, which is to try to incorporate exercise and movement into the person's daily life so that they don't have to spend a lot of time doing extra specific exercises. And yet, there are some things that we do like to recommend very precisely for that one person so that they can get back to their particular sport that they love or sit in the chair that they have to sit in for many hours a day. Sometimes it's not enough to do, from our perspective, to just correct what they're doing in that moment. Sometimes they have to have some support underpinnings in a way to get the muscles that are not doing their job properly to learn how to do their job. So we do give some exercises.
And that would alleviate the pain. That would help the pain.
That's the idea.
Which could then up the activity level.
Right. We know that certain movements cause, in certain people, cause their pain. And we can see that other movements alleviate their pain. And so we want to promote that kind of movement or exercise.
All right, well, let's go over to the calls. We've got Nario calling from Sonoma. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So what have you found works for you?
Well, about a year and a half, I was in excruciating pain to the point that I couldn't move. I took an MRI, and they found 13-millimeter herniation at L5 with stenosis and various other issues. The doctor in San Francisco suggested fusion. I refused because I'm a firm believer that we can fix ourselves somehow. I created a bracket at the end of my bed with bungee cords and a handle on top, and I stretched myself for half an hour at a time, several times a day with ice. And, ice for a little time. And I managed the pain without painkillers. I don't believe in painkillers as well.
Well, how long did you do this practice for?
For a few weeks. And at that point, I was able to actually move and do mild work. And now I'm at the point in which I move very well. In other words, I can bicycle, I can mildly run, I can do things like that, and bend. But I changed certain things, but I need help to do the next step. So I sit on a ball instead of chairs, and I find that
helps.
It keeps my lower, my pelvis moving constantly. So it's,
well, Nario, let me stop you there because we got a lot going on here that can be commented on. And Esther Gokhale, why don't you jump in? Given what you've heard, sounds like he stretches his spine.
It sounds like traction does good things for you. There's a technique we teach called stretch sitting where you can put your spine in gentle traction as you sit, kind of elongated against a backrest. You can also learn stretch lying, where you dig your elbows into the bed and kind of put yourself down one vertebra at a time with some extra length in your back. So again, even without the bungee cords, sounds like you've been really ingenious, but even without the bungee cords, you can actually put your back in gentle traction. And then you also want to learn how to use your deeper abdominal and back muscles to brace you, to make you basically slenderer and taller so that the pressure is off those problematic discs and so on.
And what you're and what this is doing is, correct me if I'm wrong, is stretching out the spine to give the discs in between a little air, a little fluid?
Little space so they can rehydrate, also giving the spinal nerves, which exit between the pairs of vertebrae, a little extra room so they're not impinged. Very simple techniques.
Paul Slozar, I want to ask you, since he mentioned fusion surgery was recommended. I know back surgery is one of those very, you know, it's funny because knee surgery is not controversial, hip surgery is not controversial. Back surgery seems to be very controversial, whether or not it's the rewards outweigh the potential problems. What is it about back surgery that separates it from other kinds of surgery and makes people so ambivalent?
One of the people who taught me years ago made a very important statement, and it stuck with me. When you hurt your back, you sometimes hurt your soul. So we have a lot of patients on the planet, not just in the United States, who suffer from back pain and become depressed. They become addicted to medications or alcohol. Their job suffers. Their marriage suffers. If somebody gets into a spiral like that, it's difficult for surgery alone to address that. That's why we do have a multidisciplinary approach with psychology and good structured preoperative pain management. But occasionally, patients do need to have the flat tire fixed.
What are the circumstances that seem to really cry out for surgery?
Well, and just to finish up, you know, a knee and a hip, they also have some challenging results too. It's just less commonly discussed. But back pain, the technology has finally caught up. The surgery lagged behind hip and knee surgery by at least 20 years. So the technology exists and the training of the surgeons has improved immensely. But the circumstances that clearly speak to surgery and specifically a fusion, number one, the patient should have 6 to 12 months of debilitating pain. That has not responded to
any
of the other treatments. And there has to be a very clear lesion or abnormality on the MRI scan. Generally, one or two level disc fusions in properly selected patients. The average patient with that type of debilitating back pain and a good surgical intervention, they'll have their pain reduced 50 to 70% reliably. So the data is coming. There is good scientific data to support the careful utilization of surgery. But unfortunately, some doctors and some patients dive into it a little bit too quickly.
What about steroid shots?
Steroids are sort of the, you know, I consider three buckets of treatment. One is the traditional physical therapy medications, all of the methods that are done without, if you will, any intervention on a medical procedure basis. The second bucket are steroids, and the third is surgical. Steroids do help some of the patients get into physical therapy and move forward, but if they're used too frequently, they can lead to osteoporosis. The patients can have some side effects. So we use them very judiciously, maybe once or twice in the course of a year, just as a bridge to get somebody into a more physically active lifestyle.
Amy, you're nodding. Amy Selinger?
Yes, and we have to be very careful in physical therapy because sometimes not a double-edged sword, but when you give the steroid injection, you can feel a lot better, and then you can move the way that makes your pain get worse in the long run. So proper physical therapy is really important in conjunction with the steroid injection oftentimes because we need to teach the person while they're feeling better to move better and to use the parts of their body they're not using well and to stabilize the parts that they're moving too much.
Do steroids just mask the pain and so you're really not dealing with the problem, or do they make the problem go away long enough that you can jump into some physical therapy and work out the issue?
We get that question at least like three times a day. But the idea of it masking the pain, the way I think of it, it's like turning the thermostat down on the furnace. If the steroids can kick the thermostat down low and you, with good body mechanics and good training, can keep it low, that's a success. And then the inflammatory component of the injury will gradually reduce. If, however, the injury is more severe and the steroid only works temporarily, the pain will come back. So they're not strong enough to completely mask it, but they can turn the inflammatory component down or off and allow people to move forward in their training.
So they can be therapeutic in conjunction with other approaches. All right, let's get to some of these many emails that have come in. Tom is writing that his cure for back pain is swimming. And Kate writes, I hurt my back 25 years ago, and at that time a doctor told me to strengthen my ab muscles. Knock on wood, 15 minutes of ab and core work every day has kept my back happy. I also walk and run every day, watch my weight, and have saying having a big belly is hard on the back. Jake writes, sit less, sit better. If you're able, try to be on your feet as much as possible during each day. I'll use that as a springboard to ask what you folks think about the kind of the movement toward away from sitting at a desk and towards standing at your desk. Esther?
I think it depends how you stand and how you sit. Both, I think, are healthy activities for it done in moderation, but they have to be done well. In general, I think we are missing something very basic in our back pain sufferers, you know, which is that they are not using their bodies well, whether it's sitting, standing, walking, bending. And it's a little bit like diet 50 years ago wasn't recognized to be very important for wellness. And now we realize that it's a basic that needs to be in place. Similarly, posture is a basic that needs to be in place even before we look into particulars, because otherwise, you know, it's like if someone has a digestive problem, but all they're eating is Twinkies, and we need to address that Twinkie problem before we start honing in on which particular nutrient they're missing. And I think it's the same with posture. People really need to learn this basic.
If a person, is there a way to sit well? As Jake is saying, sit less, but sit better. Amy, is there, how does one sit in the most advantageous way?
So there are, there's not one answer to that question.
Oh, come on.
So somebody earlier said that he sits on a ball.
Right.
And one can sit on a ball really well, and it can be a really great surface to sit on when you're writing, sitting at a desk and kind of leaning forward from your hips. But when you're at your computer all day, it can be too stressful because your back needs some support to do all that precise movement with your fingers hitting the right keys and looking at your monitor.
So it's not a good idea to sit on a ball all day at your computer.
At your computer, I would say no, although there are some ball chairs that have a backrest.
Hmm.
But there are and then there are chairs that are better for one person and better for another. I sometimes call them girl chairs and boy chairs because some chairs fit a male body type better, a more slender, not wide hip body, and other chairs fit a female body or a body that has just a wider hip profile, pelvis profile. So the type of chair makes a difference. How your chair is fit to you makes a difference. And the great thing about a lot of the chairs that you can buy today is that many of them are adjustable. So many chairs can fit many people, but they need to be adjusted to your body. And then once it's adjusted, there's not one perfect sitting chair position because you need to move during the day, and that you might want your backrest back a little bit during part of the day and to sit more upright part of the day and then to stand part of the day. So movement is actually really important.
So movement sounds like it's key.
But when you are sitting or standing, as Esther said, you want to use really good posture, and not all of us know what that good posture is.
All right, going back to the calls, James has called in from Nevada City. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm curious why we haven't heard mention of the Danish study, I believe in 2003, that found that almost a third of chronic lower back pain was attributed to infection by the bacteria that causes acne, and that a simple and inexpensive course of antibiotic treatment is capable of curing that sort of back pain. I haven't heard that mentioned.
And when was that study?
2003.
Because, boy, it sure seems if there was a slapdash ready remedy for that. I'm hearing from Dan, the producer, that it was in 2013. You'd think that the companies would have jumped all over that. Is that something familiar to you, Paul Slezar?
Yes. The data has been presented. It's met with some skepticism. the old, you know, it sounds too, if it sounds too good to be true, maybe it is. I know of at least two or three large centers that are trying to replicate that. So it's important if that is a potential option. I would be highly skeptical that that is the holy grail and will cure all the back pain on the planet. But there are large scale academic centers trying to replicate that exact study to see if it's reproducible.
All right. Well, thanks so much, James, for bringing that to our attention. Thank you.
Thank you.
And going over to Zachary in San Leandro. Hi, Zachary.
Yes. Am I on?
You sure are.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, listen, I had a herniated disc, 5 millimeters, L4-5. S1 nerve pinched, and a lot of sciatic pain. So what I did was I modified a pair of leather boots and reinforced the sides, ran some nylon rope through an eye hook in the wall, raised my bed up about a foot at the foot of the bed, and I strapped myself in or laced myself in and would lay on my stomach and go to sleep overnight and get at least 4 or 5 hours. And I went from an 8-9 pain down to like a 3 in one night. And I tracked my height, pain levels morning and night, and sleep quality and duration, and did this for about a month and a half every other day, every other night, at least 4 hours. And I actually gained about an inch and a half in height. And the pain was gone.
Wow.
It was bad. It was bad.
Well, Zachary, I'm seeing smiles all around the table. So, Amy, why don't you jump in about what you think about that?
So it sounds like he did a kind of inversion traction where he was lying face down with the boots kind of holding him up and getting a little traction. So we use traction in physical therapy. We call that inversion traction, where your feet are up higher than your head. And that can be really helpful. It's interesting that he was able to get the relief lying face down, because a lot of times when you lie face down, it increases the arch in your back. And that could be helpful for a certain type of herniated disc and certain type of back pain, but not helpful for others. But so again, I feel like I keep saying the same thing, which is that every person is a little bit different as to what is going to work. But it is a strategy that we use. Both extension is helpful for some kinds of back pain, lying on your stomach, that is, and traction is helpful for some kinds of back pain.
Well, I have to wonder, though, Zachary, are you still there?
That was ingenious,
sure.
Though. That
did,
was
quite...
did you get headaches? I mean, that's a lot of blood flow.
No,
around,
I was actually a little concerned. I didn't know, because I never did. I'm going to sleep, right? And I don't know what it's like to sleep with the foot of the bed a foot off the ground, and that's a pretty slight slope. It's nothing major, but it does.
Like how much of a slope? How much of a slope?
It's actually 11 inches by, I think the bed frame's about 6.5-7 feet, maybe 9%
huh.
Or 11%. I haven't exactly figured it out, but the key thing here for me, I figured, was sleeping, so the core muscles relax, and then sleeping and the slope.
Right. And I'd put to all of you folks here, what makes being on your belly better than being on your back for this sort of thing?
Well, it's not always better. For him, it was better because he had an injury that responded well to extension or arching of his back. When you lie on your tummy, your belly muscles are more relaxed. Your back muscles are more relaxed as well. Everything is relaxed, but they relax proportionally. So if you have stronger muscles in one area and weaker in another, they still end up kind of – the strong muscles are stiffer in a way, and the weaker muscles are looser. So he may have gone into a little more extension overnight, and that worked for him. It sounds quite ingenious for his particular issue.
And Esther Gokhale, I know you've, or at least I think I've seen in some of your work, that the recognition that the spine is a J shape rather than an S shape in its most natural form is something we often overlook.
That's a claim we make based on observation of little kids, villagers in non-industrial cultures, our ancestors. You see everybody's behind, and you see that the lumbar spine doesn't have a exaggerated curve and so on. It's actually quite elongated. So that's a contrarian view, but it's based on very logical premises and empirical evidence. And there's also radiological evidence. There's Jackson and McManus did a study showing that people who have this J spine, you know, more curve down low, less curve in the lumbar area, upper lumbar area, correlate with being healthy. And the ones who have the more S-shaped spine, actually, it correlates with back pain. So, you know, both the anthropological and the evidence and the, you know, the research studies point to this
the natural structure of having
shape.
That J.
And it's what we help people achieve.
And let's go back to some of our emails. Marianne says, or this is actually on Facebook. Marianne says, acupuncture with exclamation points. And Robert writes, exercise and stretching. Maureen says, dog's honest truth, a medical intuitive eradicated the majority of the pain, and now daily stretching helps. And Joyce writes, Pilates, acupuncture, and nothing works if you don't understand your body mechanics and the source of your pain. That makes me wonder about some conversations that have been flying around of late around yoga and people doing a bit of damage to themselves with their enthusiasm for yoga. Amy Selinger?
Yoga is interesting because if done properly, it can be very helpful for many types of bodies. When you stretch multiple things in a row, the loosest things are always going to stretch the most. So if you've got some stiff segments that you're trying to stretch, you may not end up stretching them because something looser nearby may stretch more. So you can actually make the differences between strong and loose muscles greater if you're not careful. And certain positions actually, there are certain positions that are more stressful on the back. And so with my patients who really want to practice yoga, I may ask them to avoid certain positions for their particular body. Rotational yoga positions are a little more stressful in general.
Do you find that sometimes people, it may be such a Bay Area trait or a Silicon Valley trait, the competitive nature, that yoga has almost taken on this, you know, achievement-oriented aura of how long can I hold the pose or how extreme can I make my posture or my pose. It's not very zen. It's really damaging.
And,
Esther Goffman,
you know, yoga is imported technology. It was designed by yogis for yogis originally. And if we're going to import it into our culture, we need to modify it. You know, we haven't grown up squatting on toilets. We didn't grow up eating food cross-legged on the floor. So it needs tweaks. But the great thing about yoga is that it affects not only physical health, but also emotional health. And that it has in common with posture. You know, you don't have to sit and think, is this in my head or is this in my body? You're kind of addressing it all. And I think to really solve back pain, it's going to take that kind of global approach, emotional, physical, connect people, cue people in visually, kinesthetically, intellectually. We use every arrow in our quiver to help this problem. We connect our students with each other so they're getting peer support. We appeal to their sense of self. Oh, this is the way I used to be when I was a little kid. We use it all and it takes everything. And I've been forced to design my own chair because I don't like the chairs out there. And, you know, we are building a very broad approach. And I think that's what it takes.
Well, and like you say, bringing kind of the things that we are using to our culture, and we have to bring our mind to it too. We can't just adopt the physical practice. We have to adopt, if it's yoga, for example, you know, yoga is a mindset as well as a physical practice. And so adopting both in concert as opposed to just one or the other.
Right. People have different needs and different loves. And I think that's helping people find their team, too, is really helpful. And somebody mentioned acupuncture. I don't think anybody said it, but I think for my patients, I help hook them up with an osteopath if that's what they need, or a nutritionist if that's what they need, acupuncture. And we send them, you know, we try to hook them up with a Pilates instructor or a yoga instructor that will help work with them so that they're getting what they need for their particular issue and their particular body.
All right. And we've got so many online responses. So let me get to some of those before our show has to close here in a few minutes. Jennifer's writing, I had such back pain. I could hardly get out of bed. And when I did, it took a couple of hours to move without stiffness and pain. I knew my back was healthy. So I took matters into my own hands and started yoga. I've been without pain now for 13 years. Pay attention, move, and do it religiously. This person says, let's see. Oh, we've got so many here. You're having a great conversation. Haven't heard anything about chiropractic care. And I think, Dr. Slezar, you talked a little bit about that, that you use it in concert with your other strategies. You refer people.
I do. Yeah. And actually, we're very fortunate here in the Bay Area. There are a number of what I would consider elite or sophisticated chiropractic doctors who incorporate a lot of the techniques that we've all been talking about. They're not afraid to treat the patient and educate them. They work well with physical therapists and surgeons. They understand the importance of achieving an accurate diagnosis, and they have a specific treatment that has a beginning and an end. So they play a very significant role in the overall care of back health.
All right, Eric's writing, how I solved my back pain. Used to wake every morning with back pain, nothing severe, just a constant dull pain that wouldn't go away. Then I started rowing with a rowing machine, strengthening my back and core. Haven't had a back pain in 7 years. His big thrust, he says, move. Use the muscles. That's what they're there for. And this listener writes, for me, it was to strengthen my muscles. At the time, I was active in sports and riding my bike every week. I had chronic backaches, going to the gym, blah, blah, blah. And this person just said weights, using them carefully, accurately, and targeting lower back muscles. Haven't had a lick of trouble since. Basically, what we're getting in a lot of these emails is yoga, Pilates, and movement, movement, movement. We only have less than 2 minutes left. Amy, as somebody who sees people kind of who are physically able and willing to come into your office, is there a key strategy you could give people to take away from this hour with?
I think maybe it's the core. You hear the core being discussed all in many realms, Pilates, physical therapy, even in yoga, in many areas. And there's some wonderful research by Paul Hodges and Carolyn Richardson looking at the abdominals. And one of the things we know about them is that in people without back pain, they turn on before we move our arms and legs. And no matter which direction we're moving, the abdominals turn on first and in a particular order. And people with back pain don't.
All right.
We need to train them.
Core, core, core. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. Esther Goclay is creator of the Goclay Method, and her book is called 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Practice. Paul Slezar is with the orthopedic spine care group called Spine Care Medical Group in San Francisco. And Amy Selinger is a physical therapist in California, in San Francisco. Go here. And we'll have some of their resources on our website as well, kqed.org/forum. Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi are our producers. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Dan Zoll is our executive editor. I'm Penny Nelson sitting in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.